This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says finalization of the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides of the negotiations. The Taliban militant group says it will present a peace proposal to the Afghan government as the warring sides resume the long-stalled peace talks in Qatar. Also, Iraq says a drone has been shot down over an area close to the U.S. embassy in Baghdad hours after Iraq has targeted the Ain al-Assad airbase hosting American forces. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran says finalization of any agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides involved in talks over the accord. The foreign ministry spokesman said all sides to the talks have acknowledged progress in the negotiations. However, Saeed Khatibzadeh added, important issues have remained that need to be decided on by the other parties, especially the U.S. He said Tehran's main policy is the removal of sanctions and added that policy will remain unchanged under the new Iranian government. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal began talks to revive it in April, 3 years after the U.S. left the accord. German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas has said a deal to save the accord can be reached in the coming weeks. In order to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Tim Anderson. He is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us out of Sydney, Australia. Thank you for joining us. Iran says the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal depends on the political will of the other sides of the negotiations, especially the U.S. Now, what's keeping other sides to the deal, especially the U.S., from returning to the deal, in your opinion?
Thank you. Yes, I think the main obstacle on the U.S. side is that this deal has always been an attempt to subjugate Iran, not just in relation to nuclear matters, but to try and disempower it in the region. And if it is seen in U.S. domestic politics as giving in to Iran or giving some concession to Iran, it's going to be very difficult for Washington to swallow, a very difficult pill to swallow, because it will be seen to be losing a type of leverage against Iran. So that's why I think there's quite an intransigence on the U.S. side.
Heiko Maas said on Monday that he was confident that the talks would reach their intended result or goal in the coming weeks. Now, my question is, what has changed in your opinion, or what issues have been resolved that allow for such a comment on the future of the talks?
Well, I think it's a generic sort of optimism, really, because the Europeans have done little to try and maintain this agreement. They've been too weak to stand up against the Trump administration when it reneged on the deal. And from the Iranian side, I mean, I know certainly the current administration would like to see an outcome there, and perhaps they're talking positively about it, but I don't think they're going to give in to their position, which is a strong moral position that the U.S. has to show some real dropping of sanctions. And so I don't really think that the Iranian side is going to make any concessions, and I don't think that the Washington side is capable of doing it. So I think the German official is really using a bit of unfounded optimism there.
Okay. As you kind of said, we've been constantly hearing the same line that, you know, progress has been made, but important issues have remained. Apparently, at least one of the major issues that hasn't been resolved yet is how the steps are going to be implemented. In your opinion, how these steps are going to be implemented?
Really, I'm in the pessimist's camp. I don't think it's going to work out, basically. There may be some goodwill, and that's worth something. It's worth something if the sides are talking to each other and there's some goodwill there. But in terms of returning to the 2015 agreement, I just don't think it's going to happen. I think there may be some other accommodation beyond the 2015 deal, but I think returning to that is virtually impossible in these circumstances. However, it might be that the Biden administration is able to start talking to Iran on a different basis and perhaps remove some of the sanctions there. Remember, there are a number of sanctions that the U.S. They shouldn't be called sanctions. They're unilateral coercive measures. They're illegal, basically. But I think that the Biden administration might try and soften some of those as some sort of concession to keep a dialogue of goodwill going with Tehran. But I don't look for much more than that.
Mm-hmm. And let's just talk about that a little bit. You said that you think that it's impossible under current circumstances for the sides that are involved in the talks over the revival of the nuclear deal to you know, get any positive results out of it. I want you to discuss what those circumstances are that do not allow for the revival of the of the deal. And also, do you think Iran or the U.S., do you think Iran has always been persistent in their calls and in their claims that they are not going to change their policy towards the deal because they want the removal of the sanctions and they're not going to compromise that? But do you think the U.S. is willing to make any kind of compromises here, any trade-offs here as well or not?
I think they may, for the sake of appearances and for the sake of strategically shifting their position in the region. Remember, Iran is important to them in terms of having some leverage or leverage on Iran and some influence on Iran, because they really are trying to remove the influence that Iran has on the resistance more broadly in the region. That is to say, the countries that are independent and are against the Israeli enemy in the region. So I think there may be a shift to trying to have a better dialogue with Iran. But the intransigence on the U.S. side, as I said, it's really a lot to do with the fact that they don't want to be seen to allowing Iran to get a win. And that's the way it seems in these circumstances. Because after all, Iran stuck to its side of the deal. The Trump administration reneged. Now the Biden administration is not prepared to go back to the position that Biden himself as vice president supported in 2015. So Iran has the high moral ground here, and there's no real need for them to shift. I think even though the two sides of the two broad sides of politics in Iran have a different view on the agreement, I think there is good reason to think that they'll maintain the same position, because Iran doesn't have to do much. It has to say, look, we'll maintain our position if you come back to the table. And the U.S. is finding incredibly difficult to come back to the table and come back to agreeing to the deal that they signed up to 6 years ago.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. That was Tim Anderson, the director of Center of Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He's also a prolific author. Thank you for joining us, sir. Now, moving on, the Taliban say they're planning to present a written peace proposal to the Afghan government as early as next month. A spokesman for the militant group said the peace talks with the government will be accelerated in the coming days. Zabihullah Mujahid added that the talks will take a month before the two sides reach a stage where they can exchange peace plans. A new round of talks began in Qatar capital Doha last week. That coincided with the U.S. handover of Bagram Air Base near Kabul to the Afghan forces almost after two decades. The U.S. has already announced a complete pullout of its forces from Afghanistan before September the 11th. However, former Afghan President Hamid Karzai has described the U.S.-led NATO mission in his country as a failure.
In terms of the main U.S. and allies' objective, in which the Afghan people also shared, joined hands, an end to extremism, stability in Afghanistan, peace in our country? No. It has been disastrous for us.
Do things that are hard.
Karzai said the Afghan people are now paying a heavy price for the failure of foreign forces in the country. He urged the government and the Taliban to sit down for talks at the earliest to secure a lasting peace. His call comes as the militant group has continued expanding its hold over territories across Afghanistan. Local groups in some provinces are joining forces to put up an armed resistance against the Taliban. Here's more.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by U.S. President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Earlier, political commentator Mike Harris told us about the real motives behind the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Let's take a listen.
First of all, no one believes that Afghanistan had anything to do with 9/11, which was the justification for entering Afghanistan in the first place. So that story, that lie that has been foisted upon the American people of the world is coming to an end. The truth is going to come out about who the real perpetrators were about 9/11, and it was not, and Afghanistan had nothing to do with it. The real motivation for the U.S. being in Afghanistan was to secure the opium market. And I have to point out that when the Taliban was in control before the U.S. invasion, production of opium was merely 74 metric tons annually. And the high it reached was 94,000 metric tons in 2017, right prior to Trump announcing that he was going to withdraw troops out of Afghanistan. So there's other reasons why the U.S. has been there, why the U.S. has been there for so long. It has to do with the CIA, has to do with black money, and it has to do with the drug trafficking and the drug problem globally.
Iraqi security officials say a drone has been intercepted and shut down by American forces over an area close to the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. The officials said the drone was down before reaching the embassy compound. Videos posted on social media showed American defense systems firing rockets into the air in Baghdad. The incident comes hours after the U.S.-led military coalition said at least three rockets targeted the Ain al-Assad airbase hosting American forces in western Iraq. It said the attack left no injuries but caused material damage to the base. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for that attack. U.S. bases and their supply convoys in Iraq have come under increasing attacks amid growing anti-American sentiment in the Arab country. Lebanon's Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah describes resistance media as partners in all victories achieved so far against the oppressors. He also praises the media for breaking the U.S. hegemony in the region. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Sayed Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayed Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression.
The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayed Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
French prosecutors say they are investigating claims that a Saudi prince kept seven women in a state of modern slavery. The women, most of them from the Philippines, were recruited in Saudi Arabia and worked for the prince and his family in a posh neighborhood in Paris. The prosecutors have also opened human trafficking charges into the case against Prince Faisal bin Turki bin Abdullah Al Saud. French media reported that the women barely had time to eat and were found while crying with hunger. The women filed complaints of modern-day slavery in October 2019. Well, that's your war news for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
one of, if not the worst heat wave in the region's modern records, impacted the Pacific Northwest of the United States and Western Canada during late June 2021, not just breaking records, but smashing them over an incredibly hot four-day period. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tom DiLiberto, reporter. This article is published under the heading, Astounding Heat Obliterates All-Time Records Across the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. Stay tuned for more. One of, if not the worst heat wave in the region's modern records impacted the Pacific Northwest of the U.S. and Western Canada during late June 2021, not just breaking records but smashing them over an incredibly hot four-day period. And unlike the heat wave across the Southwest United States in mid-June, this time the dangerous heat was felt across a region not known for such extremes. A week after a heat wave broke records across Southwest and Northern Mountain West, a second heat wave occurred across the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. It sent records toppling over a four-day period, June 26th to June 29th daytime. High temperatures skyrocketed to well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, setting all-time records at dozens of locations. Portland, Oregon's average high temperature over this period was 112 degrees Fahrenheit, the hottest three-day period on record by an astonishing 6 degrees. All 3 days, 108 on June 28, 112 on June 27th, and 116 on June 28th, set all-time heat records for the city. Seattle, Washington also had back-to-back days that set all-time heat records. 108 on June 28, after reaching 104 the day prior. In fact, in the previous 126 years, Seattle had only hit 100 degrees three times. It reached that mark in three consecutive days in June. The heat reached right to the coast, too, as Quailut, Washington, on the Pacific Ocean, reached an all-time record of 110 degrees Fahrenheit, a mere 45 degrees above average, beating the previous record by a mind-boggling 11 degrees. The heat was so intense that roads buckled across the Northwest. And the heat didn't stop at the U.S.-Canada border. Western Canada also baked under an oppressive amount of heat. According to Environment Canada, Lytton, British Columbia, reached 116 degrees Fahrenheit. That is about 46.1 degrees Celsius. On June 27th, setting a new all-time heat record for all of Canada. That record lasted for all of one day, as the temperature soared to 118 degrees, that is about 47.5 degrees Celsius on June 28th. And that record lasted for all of one day, as it reached a shocking 121 degrees, 49.5 degrees Celsius on June 29th. The previous all-time heat record for the entire country before this past weekend, that was 113 degrees Fahrenheit or 45 degrees Celsius, was broken by 8 degrees. Heck, according to Environment Canada, on June 29, six other locations also exceeded the previous all-time heat record for Canada. To put this into perspective, the temperature in Lytton was hotter than has ever been recorded in Las Vegas, Nevada, except Lytton is located 1,000 miles north and 50 degrees north latitude. As
us with the most questions about the atmosphere. There are multiple answers. The most direct cause of the blistering heat was a high-pressure system stronger than ever observed in the region that sat over the region for several days, unwilling to move like a stubborn dog on a walk. The cloudless skies and sinking air associated with the high pressure helped record temperatures build. Adding to the heat in some locations was the prevailing winds, which is in northern hemisphere always blow clockwise around high pressure. Due to the topography of the region, mountains and high plateaus, easterly winds bring air from high elevation to lower elevations, which causes it to compress and heat up. These winds are called downslope winds, and they are known to kick temperatures up a notch all along the West Coast. And finally, while there has not been an attribution study yet on this heat wave, climate change likely had an influence as well. As noted in the article on the previous record temperatures, heat waves across the contagious United States have occurred more often and lasted longer since 1960s. According to NOAA's Climate Extremes Index, the percent area of the Pacific Northwest that has experienced summertime extreme temperatures has drastically increased over the last 20 years. For the first 9 years of the record, an extreme heat footprint of larger than 50% of the area happened only 3 times. In the past 20 years, it has happened 6 times. In the future, according to the Climate Science Special Report, the scientific basis for the fourth National Climate Assessment, heat waves are projected to continue to get hotter, occur more often, and last longer in the future due to the emissions of greenhouse gases. Extreme heat this far north is particularly dangerous as these locations have a lot less experience with temperatures that high. Communities in the Southwest, for instance, have previous knowledge of temperatures over 100 degrees. Those in the Northwest and Canada simply do not. And this manifests itself through the built environment. Air conditioner use in the Southwest is virtually mandatory, yet in Seattle, according to the New York Times, there is a culture against air conditioner use. NPR notes that Seattle ranks as the least air-conditioned city in a comparison of the top 15 metro areas in the U.S. Only 44% of homes in Seattle have primary air conditioning installed. Things are slightly better in Portland at 78% of homes, but it's still far below the nationwide average. Commenting on the event, in a listserv for weather experts, Seattle resident Dale Duran, a professor in the Atmospheric Science Department at the University of Washington, described the covering his windows with foam core insulation board to block the incoming sun. It's not just that we don't have air conditioning, he wrote, it's that our built environment is optimized for what used to be our climate. In Seattle, we build modern houses in a way that would be inconceivable in a hot climate. We not only do not have air conditioning, we like to have lots of windows, including south-facing ones. A lack of resources to cool a population during extreme heat conditions can lead to dangerous health outcomes. It's likely too early to know the full health toll from this heat wave, but it serves as a reminder of dangers of extreme heat, both today and in a warming world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saudi Arabia, a kingdom notorious for excessive use of capital punishment. Any protest against the Saudi government might cost the protesters their lives, no matter how old they might be. Reports released by some whistleblowers indicate that a number of young Saudis are on death row for participating in anti-government protests in Eastern Province. Since 2011, the province has been the scene of peaceful demonstrations by Shia Muslims against social and political, as well as economic and religious discrimination. According to Saudi leaks, the Saudi authorities are planning to execute dozens of teenagers from the Shia-populated Qatif region in Eastern Province for their participation in peaceful protests against the regime. More than 40 teenagers now face the death penalty only because they took part in pro-democracy rallies in 2011 or later.
I guess the Saudis, that's their career, that's their behavior for behaving in a very strange and barbaric manner against these people in eastern and in southern part in Saudi Arabia, especially the opposition people who try or who dare to challenge the Saudi despotic regime.
The report came less than a week after Saudi authorities executed 26-year-old Shia Muslim Mustafa al-Darwish. Al-Darwish was arrested in May 2015 on protest-related charges when he was 17 years old. He was executed on June 15 in Dammam, according to a statement issued by the Saudi Ministry of Interior.
The Saudis, they treat the people in Saudi Arabia in an atrocious manner, and they think that they are slaves for them. They use them and they prevent them from the most simplest rights in that place.
According to Reprieve, al-Darwish was placed in solitary confinement and beaten so badly that he lost consciousness several times. To make the torture stop, he confessed to the charges against him. In fact, al-Darwish is the latest victim of Riyadh's deeply flawed justice system, which regularly sees people sentenced to death after unfair trials. He was a member of the marginalized Shia Muslim majority in the region of Qatif, an oil-rich region with deprived inhabitants.
The Shias in Saudi Arabia, in the Arabian Peninsula, whether in Bahrain or in Arabian Peninsula, they have been treated manly in a very harsh manner also. But also other people of the Muslims and also Christians, any human want to be in a position side against this medievalist regime, this backward regime, I guess they have certain kind of treatment, like harsh, like trying to belittle or trying to do even kill others.
Saudi Arabia is known as a world leader in capital punishment and has conducted several mass executions. In 2019, the kingdom executed 37 men, most of them Shia, convicted in unfair trials.
The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, today strongly condemned the beheading of 37 men in spite of repeated appeals by UN Human Rights System about the lack of due process and fair trial guarantees, allegations that confessions were obtained through torture, and the age of some of those executed. According to available information, at least three of those executed were minors at the time they were sentenced. And the UN Human Rights Office now says that most of the 37 belonged to Shia Muslim minority. Some had also been involved in protests.
Faced with international pressure, Saudi King Salman decreed last year that crimes committed by minors, that's anyone under 18, would no longer be punished by death. In March 2021, the death sentences of some of the high-profile men such as Ali al-Nimr, Dawood al-Marhoun, and Abdullah al-Zahir were changed accordingly. They were between the ages of 15 and 17 when they were first arrested.
The reform, when you give the freedom to the people, not imprison them for just they are so and so politically or culturally even or religiously, I guess this is a backwardness. And I don't think this kind of mind, of mentality, it would be very, not only difficult, it would be impossible to say that they would bring reform. Reformation, first of all, means to change your mentality. And, well, we don't see that.
Yet the punishment remains possible for men like Abdullah al-Hawaiti for crimes they allegedly committed as children. More than 26,000 people have signed a reprieve petition to prevent his execution.
This kind of regime with no legislative body, no constitution, no election, and no nothing of what's so called in this modern world about freedom and liberty. And I guess it's about now for the international community to bring this regime into justice instead of this regime to bring all these people and execute them, especially the teenagers who really need to go to the schools, to the universities, and to be encouraged in this life. On the contrary, they put them down in order to belittle them and to do all the bad things to them.
Where is the justice? Al-Hawaiti's mother tweeted in Arabic on June 16. We call on the relevant authorities to intervene and save the innocent and hold the corrupt who are hiding accountable. In the words of Michael Page, Deputy Middle East Director at Human Rights Watch, Al-Hawaiti's court proceedings flouted almost every internationally recognizable fair trial guarantee. Yet a Saudi court still sentenced him to die for a crime allegedly committed when he was 14.
The regime, I guess, belongs to the history, doesn't belong to any kind of humanitarian trend or to a modern trend. And whatever they say about this regime will be historically treated in a very bad manner. This is not a regime. If we say regime, is a big word for this. This is a kind of tribal behavior against every human that would be against the tribe.
Since 2018, Saudi Arabia has had a law on the books preventing the death penalty for crimes committed by juveniles. But in practice, it is open to interpretation and can be circumvented. By executing minors, Riyadh wants to make it clear that it would not forgive those who take to the streets calling for reforms. By a cruel irony, the Saudi crown prince and de facto leader, Mohammed bin Salman, has been seeking to present himself as the champion of reforms in the kingdom. Executing Shia minors above all else reveals the hypocrisy of the Saudi ruling system, which tries to be known for things it does not really believe in.
In the limelight.
The remaining part of a collapsed building in South Florida was demolished in a burst of explosives that took the unstable structure down in seconds, after officials worried that it might not withstand the powerful winds of an approaching tropical storm and that rescue workers could be endangered. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Sophie Casico, Jesus Jimenez, Julia Hayward, Michael LaForgia, and Adam Playford. The piece is titled, "The Remaining Structure at the Surfside Condo Has Been Demolished." Stay with us for more. The remaining part of a collapsed building in South Florida was demolished in a burst of explosives that took the unstable structure down in seconds, after officials worried that it might not withstand the powerful winds of an approaching tropical storm and that rescue workers could be endangered. The demolition, which took place at 10:30 p.m. local time on Sunday, 4th of July, came as officials warned residents to stay inside in case dust and other particles polluted the air. Anguished families continued to search for news in the search for 121 people still missing since the building in Surfside collapsed more than a week ago. Rescue efforts had halted for much of the weekend amid growing worries about the unstable structure. Officials said that the demolition, which was initially thought to be weeks away, was needed to restart rescue efforts. They described the operation as one that would be contained to as small a footprint as possible, and that would aim to avoid disturbing the area where rescuers have been searching for the missing. "Our top priority is bringing down this building," Mayor Daniela Levine Cava of Miami-Dade County said on Sunday. "As soon as the building does come down, when the site has been deemed secure and we are given the all clear, our search and rescue teams will immediately resume their operations," she said. Later on Sunday, the authorities identified another victim of the collapse, David Epstein, a 58-year-old. The death toll remains unchanged at 24. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida said that concerns about the remaining part of the building left few options but demolition. Many residents of the building who survived had fled the portion that remained standing. Many left with whatever they had with them in the moment of the collapse and have not been permitted to enter the teetering structure since. Passports, wedding rings, cherished photographs were left behind. "At the end of the day, that building is too unsafe to let people go back in," Ron DeSantis said. "I know there's a lot of people who were able to get out, fortunately, who have things there. We're very sensitive to that, but I don't think that there's any way you could let someone go back up into that building given the shape that it's in right now. Governor Ron DeSantis said that while Surfside was not expected to see the worst of an arriving tropical storm, the city could still experience strong winds and heavy rain. On Sunday, 4th of July, Tropical Storm Elsa was about 40 miles southeast of Cabo Cruz, Cuba, with winds of up to 60 miles per hour, according to the National Hurricane Center. Tropical Storm Elsa, which was downgraded from a Category 1 hurricane on Saturday, was expected to make landfall near the Florida Keys by Monday, then move over parts of Florida's west coast on Tuesday and Wednesday, according to forecasters. We want to make sure that we control which way the building falls and not a hurricane, Mayor Charles Burkett of Surfside said. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava said the method of demolition relied on explosives and gravity to take the building remains down. She also said that the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Team had swept the building three times to search for pets and animals left behind. The latest information we have is that there are no animals remaining in the building, Ms. Levine Carver said. Bringing down the remaining part of the tower might help searchers access part of the rubble they could not safely reach before, according to Ms. Levine Carver. Kevin Guthrie, director of the Florida Division of Emergency Management, said one-third of the debris pile has yet to be searched. Florida's high-rise building regulations have long been among the strictest in the nation. But after parts of the Champlain Towers South tumbled down on 24th of June, killing at least 24 people and leaving 121 others unaccounted for, evidence has mounted that those rules have been enforced unevenly by local government, and sometimes not at all. Miami-Dade County officials said last week that they were prioritizing reviews of 24 multi-story buildings that either had failed major structural or electrical inspections required after 40 years or had not submitted the reports in the first place. But the county's own records show that 17 of those cases had been open for a year or more. Two cases were against properties owned by the county itself. The oldest case had sat unresolved since 2008. The city of North Miami Beach had tried and failed for years to bring a 10-story condominium building within its borders, the Crestview Towers, into compliance with the 40-year recertification requirements. When the building's condo association finally submitted the required paperwork last week, about 9 years late, it documented critical safety concerns, a city spokesman said. Officials evacuated the building on Friday, 2nd of July. Meanwhile, the same local governments were pursuing a haphazard approach to identify other potentially unsafe buildings across the region, with the age and the height criteria that would prompt added scrutiny varying from one place to the next. At least one local government, the village of Key Biscayne, was opting to conduct no extra inspections at all, according to an official there. Even if building auditors focus only on towers of 10 stories or more that were built in the 1970s and the 1980s, the task would still be daunting. An analysis of property records by the New York Times shows that at least 270 such buildings dot the skylines of Miami-Dade County's cities, villages, and towns, with dozens more in the county's unincorporated reaches.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
On June 22nd, the U.S. government took down a range of Iranian news websites, including English-language Press TV and Arabic-language Al Alam, a far-reaching crackdown on the Iranian media. Press TV's users were faced with this message. The domain PressTV.com has been seized by the United States government in accordance with a seizure warrant pursuant. The message was part of a broader campaign against the resistance movement in West Asia, as some non-Iranian websites, like those belonging to Yemen's Al-Masira TV channel and Bahrain's Lo'lo television network, were targeted as well.
The move shows that the resistance front enjoys wide-spanning influence because the U.S. government has breached the values it claims to be upholding. The U.S. action is not the first of its kind. During the past 3 or 4 years, many measures have been taken to hinder Iran's speedy progress in the virtual space, from removing Iranian apps in violation of international laws to imposing sanctions on Iranian firms to prevent them from accessing software distribution platforms.
Shortly after, the U.S. Justice Department confirmed in a statement that, pursuant to court orders, the United States seized 33 websites used by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union, IRTVU, and 3 websites operated by Kata'ib Hezbollah, KH, in violation of U.S. sanctions.
The latest measure by the U.S. is against the same principles of free speech, which the country has always been proud of. That means curtailing free speech. The measure means that the U.S. is using tools to prevent the reflection of different viewpoints to the public. The Iranian government condemns this measure.
The seizure timing was suspicious enough, as it came one day after the Iranian president-elect Ebrahim Raisi ruled out a meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden while calling on Washington to lift sanctions on Tehran and rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Press TV was launched in 2007 with the motto of The Voice of the Voiceless. Since the very beginning, the news channel has always tried to shed light on major regional and global issues from perspectives either ignored or distorted by the mainstream media. Over the past years, the channel has repeatedly been subject to censorship on multiple platforms, including Twitter and Instagram, besides Google and its services. For example, it was in mid-January 2020 that tech giant Google permanently removed Press TV UK's YouTube channel. The channel had over 28,000 subscribers on its YouTube account at the time of its deletion.
It just goes to show how wafer-thin all the Western propaganda about media freedom, freedom of speech, and so on really is. The truth is they want their overweening narrative to completely dominate the public discourse so that decisions made about Iran, war and peace, sanctions, not sanctions, the nuclear deal or not, they want those decisions to be made with an uninformed public.
A few years earlier, in 2013, Press TV was forced off the air in the UK after media regulator Ofcom revoked its license for allegedly breaching the Communications Act. Shortly after, the channel was also taken off air in North America.
I don't obviously agree with everything Press TV do, but what they do do is they provide a means for dialogue and discussion and understanding of the Middle East, particularly, and not only the Middle East, but many other world issues. Now, this vital conduit of news and information is being closed off by the British government, who are blaming it all on Ofcom. The British government won't take any responsibility for this outrageous, tyrannical act.
In fact, Press TV has had a long history of poor treatment at the hands of the